This Christmas, get ready for something truly magical as Yule Fest Kilkenny proudly presents the Irish debut of Starlight by Lux Morales, a 360-degree immersive light and sound show bringing you on a powerful journey into the heart of Christmas. For 8 spectacular nights from December 14th to 21st, the show will transform St. Canice's Cathedral into a breathtaking immersive world of sound and light. This is a Christmas event not to be missed. Tickets are selling fast, so get yours now at yulefestkilkenny.ie.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. We have a bumper show this week. I'm going to be talking to Steve Coogan and Aina Hardwick about playing Mick McCarthy and Roy Keane, respectively, in the new film Saipan. Timothy Spall, Andrea Riseborough and Toni Collette talk to me about their new Netflix film Goodbye June that was directed by Kate Winslet. Chris Wasser will be here to talk about Avatar. And as if all that wasn't enough, Tom Kenny. Who's Tom Kenny? He voices SpongeBob. He's here talking about the strange career he's had, voicing a sponge for the last 25 years of his career. I'll also be talking to the man who plays Patrick in SpongeBob in the new movie, SpongeBob Search for SquarePants. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're managing the Christmas madness. I have a bit of a cold, I'm sorry to say. It's funny, here in the office, you mention you have any kind of sniffle, people are running away from you. I'm fine, but I'm just conscious of the fact that people are terrified about getting sick so close to Christmas. And if you are sick, I am sorry, because I was a bit poorer earlier in the week, and it's no fun when you've a lot of work to do and a lot of Christmas fun on the horizon. But anyway, I do hope you're well, and if I am a little nasally, do bear with me, dear listeners. Now, I have to mention the tragic passing of Rob Reiner at the start of the show, and indeed his wife. Rob Reiner, you know, aside from being a brilliant film director with When Harry Met Sally and Spinal Tap, was also just a great guest when you saw him on things. None more so than when he was on Curb Your Enthusiasm opposite Larry David briefly. A great guest on Howard Stern and David Letterman. A real sad loss to the world, not just of Hollywood. Talking of Hollywood, we do have to also mention the somewhat strange news, I thought, that in 2029, the Oscars are going to be shown exclusively on YouTube. I'm not sure what I make of that. Is it the death of terrestrial TV? I don't think so. It's probably just changing viewing habits. We're still going to watch the Oscars. It's still going to be live. The Oscars, I don't know. You know, I'm a big fan of them because they get people watching movies. They've become very big in the last few years. Like, there's been a lot of things at them, from, you know, people making political speeches to people slapping people. And they've been very newsworthy, and they've been getting people watching movies. So I think the important thing is that they stay going, whether they were watching them on YouTube or on terrestrial TV. I do know that most of the Oscars are now consumed the next day on clips. So maybe this was inevitable, but let's see. I'd be much more worried if the Oscars was shutting up shop. The fact that they're not going to show it on terrestrial TV is less of a worry to me. But maybe I have my head in the sand about the death of terrestrial TV. Talking of TV, it's not terrestrial, it's on Paramount Plus. This is called The Revenge Club.
So I went to the house, dropped the keys off, and there they all were. Turns out her parents had bought them the house. Dan's name might be on the deeds, but he hadn't even bothered telling me.
What kind of people do that?
So your best friend stole your husband? And then she stole your company.
I couldn't face work for months, and then her dad offered me peanuts to buy it just to keep the lights on, apparently, but I was too wrecked to care.
Yeah. And now they're both living in your house.
You just want to hurt them, don't you? Scream at them. Make them feel what you feel.
I've got a confession. I'm not here by choice. I was ordered by a court because I may have punched Charlotte in the face. Oh.
Yes, that's a clip from The Revenge Club, which I was watching this week. We reviewed it on Pat Kenny's series Box this week. This is 6 episodes on Paramount Plus, and as you heard there, it's 6 people who come together who are in a divorce group, a support group. They've all had marriages break down, and they come together to share their experiences. And they're a motley crew, but what happens is they meet in the pub afterwards, and as you heard there, they start to consider maybe getting some mild revenge on the people they've broken up with. The revenge ratchets up, let's say. This is very entertaining. It hasn't gotten great reviews. I think it's pretty funny. It's a dramedy. It's dark, but it's also very funny. There's a former army captain who's refusing to accept that his marriage is over. There's a kind of young woman who's married to an influencer. It's very funny in places, and we get to learn about their exes. It starts with dead bodies, so you know it gets kind of dark eventually, and it does get pretty dark, but funny. So The Revenge Club on Paramount Plus, pretty entertaining. If you're looking for a little, I was going to say escapism. It's not really escapism because it's there's murder at play, but it's funny. It's worth a watch, I think. Believe me, I know you do, for the most part. Now, something that is terrific is a movie that's opening next week, next Friday, not this Friday, but next Friday, Stevens' Day, and it's Saipan.
You know, when I was a young footballer, they were training us to be athletes. Now we're athletes, they're training athletes to be footballers. Do you know what I mean? You know, the game's changed.
Oh, undoubtedly.
And we need to be prepared. It's not you having a stopover in Saipan if it's going to have a bad effect with lads.
Why would it have a bad effect?
Well, we're travelling for over a day for a start. I mean, that airport nonsense was chaos. There's no need for that, Mick.
Humility is important, Roy. When I was captain, Big Jack would always tell me...
Right, Big Jack. Big Jack was an English fellow who liked to pat Irish lads in the head.
Yes, Saipan. You've heard a lot about this. I told you about it back in the summer because I went to see it. Back in the summer, it tells the story of Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy in Saipan and the fallout. And it's terrific. It really is. It's 90 minutes long and it tells the tale in blistering fashion. Ana Hardwick just inhabits, absolutely inhabits Roy Keane. He's terrific as him. And Steve Coogan is great as Mick McCarthy. So I got to talk to Ana Hardwick, who's been on the show before, one of our great rising stars. He's been in movies like Lakelands. He was in Normal People all those years ago. It's only 5 years ago, but it seems like a long time ago now. He's one of our stars. He really is. And Steve Coogan, does he need any introduction? I don't think he does. So I caught up earlier in the week with Steve Coogan and Ana Hardwick to talk about Saipan and playing Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy. Steve, I was 20, I think, when all this happened, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And it's no exaggeration to say it was like a civil war. I mean, families and friends were divided about it. You were in London or somewhere at the time, I imagine. Did you have any sense of it at the time, or when you
yes,
get
definitely.
This script, you did?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I am sort of second generation Irish.
Sure.
So there was very much discussion in the household as like what who was right and who was wrong, and also being from Manchester, my family were United fans, but Mick was all because we're also Northerners, so we could you could identify with Mick if you wanted, or Roy, it was your choice. So, but it was definitely something I was aware of, this big argument that was cut into the heart of what was the right attitude to have.
Yeah.
So yes, I was. I mean, I was I'm a lot older than you. So I was in my 30s when all this was going on. But yeah, very very aware of it. And then when I heard that they were making a film out of it, I do remember thinking, well, that wasn't that long ago. Why are they making a film? It's not, what is it? Is it that, you know, culturally important? But I did a film years ago called 24 Hour Party People.
Yeah.
And I said, why are they making a film about this? It only happened a few. It's only last year, wasn't it? All this stuff. And then you find out, no, it's actually now become, it's history now. And it's history. And this is cultural history. And and it's quite nice when you make a film about it, you mark that moment and say, and it's almost like it gives it official recognition, not just as a bit of trivia, but something that was that mattered.
Yeah, Aina, you know, you capture Keane so well in his tautness, like his physical tautness, but his emotional kind of tautness. And, you know, at that time and even now, he seems to have this almost Buddhist-like inner calm and then fits of wild rage. Like, it's a real strange conundrum of a character. And I know it's acting, but how did you get to that place?
I loved the process, I have to say. And I think it, with Steve and I have spoke a lot about playing real people, and you consume all of the footage and all of the voice stuff and all of, you read everything you can. And I love all that because it sort of serves so much up to you to then kind of walk into. It was a bit like rehearsal, really. It was a bit like rehearsing for a play. It just kind of like... trying things on and moving towards it, really. And then at some point, just forgetting that you're playing a public figure and realizing that, you know, the only reason we're telling this story isn't, you know, isn't necessarily because these are public figures, but because of this particular event. This says about, you know, the country, but also about the psyche of these men. And so I kind of did all that work and then just tried to put myself in that situation, go, what would you do if you were in this high pressured, highly scrutinized place? And I suppose the one touchstone I had, well, there was many, but like the one touchstone I had was, it struck me that I think Roy Keane has a really like kind of formidable discipline, work ethic and commitment to kind of give his everything, even when the situation is not ideal. And I think that's it's an amazing quality. And so I just tried to tell myself, like, try and show up with that kind of spirit. Because I suppose I was worried that, you know, when you're playing someone who is very far from you in many ways, that you might lose a hold of that. So that was kind of, that was my sort of touchstone day to day. I just enjoyed it immensely. Like, he was a massive figure when I was growing up. And
sure.
So, you know, it was almost like a joke to me that I got to go off and play.
For me, acting opposite Aina was, because he's playing Roy, really he is the engine. Sort of drives, is the energy that drives the movie and does the heavy lifting in some ways. What I have to do is just react to what Aina's doing, and that Aina really did embody something. I don't know if it was Roy Keane, but it was a volcano that it's just basically stood in front of. So, you know, I mean, it's a tribute to Aina that he was brought this energy to the film. But it was also not just that, it was probably quite similar to probably what Mick McCarthy went through, trying to manage some of this force of nature, basically.
Yeah, the row scene, the penultimate or the ultimate row, is, even though I knew exactly what was coming, I watched from behind my hands. It was brilliant. Steve, can I just ask you in closing, you'll be pleased to hear, or maybe not, I'm sure lots of people in these situations bring up a certain fictionalized character. I'm not going to. I'm going to ask you about another TV show called The Trip, which I absolutely love. And I don't think it gets the love it deserves, because I think it's the funniest show of the last 10 years. But I wonder, you know, when you read on that, the paper pitch, right? Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon are going to go around on a restaurant tour and basically do impressions over dinner. It seems this is just a flight of famous actors. We'll have to say no to this. Yeah. But yet it turned out to be this. It's just genius. And I know that's a word bandied around, but I wonder, what was the, how did you come up with it? That's a long way of saying, like, where did that idea come from?
Put simply, everything you say is exactly our reaction. Rob and I were like, this is pointless. There isn't an idea here, in fact. It was like Winterbottom and said, you two guys talk about stuff. We did a little bit of improvisation in a film called Cock and Bull Story, which was wet weather cover. It was raining outside, so we went in the makeup trailer and did some improvisation and filmed it. And Michael said, we can make a TV series out of this. And Rob and I kept saying no, because we thought there wasn't enough meat on the bone. It was too thin an idea, like you said.
Yeah.
And it was only after the third time we were asked, I said to Rob, look, let's just find out if it's going to be any good. We might as well. If it doesn't work, it will be a good faith experiment. And it did work. And we realized, I thought, this is weird. You know, so we just did another one in Scandinavia, which will be out next year. So
it's wonderful. I was going to say, would you consider Ireland But I guess
I wanted to go to Ireland. I wanted to. Well, we did Scandinavia, but I want to do Ireland because I know a lot about it. Rob talked about Wales, but I argued, I think it was successful. There's not enough meat on the bone of a Welsh. You run out of steam very quickly, whereas Ireland, you can definitely do 6.5 hours in Ireland and have room and have change afterwards.
Yes, absolutely. Well, listen, lovely to see you both. The film Saipan, I reviewed it on this station during the summer and I said it was 5 stars. So I'm not just blowing smoke up your behind. So well done, lads. And cheers. Continued Thank success you, to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Steve Coogan there, talking about The Trip, the new season that's coming. But he was ostensibly talking about playing Mick McCarthy in Saipan. And you also heard me talking there to the man who plays Roy Keane, Aina Hardwick there. And they do a great job. And Saipan is in the cinema from the 26th of December. That's Stevens' Day. So next Friday. I know time is kind of fluid at the moment and days of the week are starting to lose their significance to a certain extent. But Saipan is a great watch. And you will be there. You will be back. 2002. I felt it was pro-Keane until the end. Then it's a bit more balanced and nuanced, I would suggest. But it's in cinemas from next week, the 26th of December. Loads to come after the break. We're going to be talking about the new Avatar film. We're also going to be talking to Toni Collette and Timothy Spall about their new Netflix film, Goodbye June. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. We turn to the week's new cinema release. Well, one of them, and I said that singularly because it's a massive cinema release. Avatar is back. The third outing, Avatar Fire and Ash. James Cameron's third in a proposed 5-movie span. I remember vividly really not liking the second one, The Way of Water. I didn't make it to this one for various reasons. However, to do the heavy lifting is our regular reviewer, arts journalist and film critic, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello, sir.
John, how are you? It's very heavy lifting this week.
Yes, and we've only given you one movie because it's such heavy lifting. Okay, yeah. I don't go out of my way to ever, you know, pee all over a movie, if that's the correct term of doing it. I tend to move on. I really did not like The Way of Water. I think I gave it 1 star 3 years ago because I felt it was a screensaver and it just kind of annoyed me for all the money that was spent on it. Part of me was thinking, you know, the state of the world, is this what we're spending our money on? And I never go there. So tell me, has it all been redeemed?
It hasn't, no. And you know what? I don't go out of my way either to, you know,
oh, I know you
try and to try and drag down James Cameron. I think my problems with the Avatar films aren't the way that they look, although I do have an issue with that. My main problem is on the page. You know, the tin plotting that Cameron has come up with in the 20-odd years that he's been working on this thing. The story just isn't there. And it kind of annoys me that Cameron, you know, and a wise film critic, Darren Mooney, said to me a couple of weeks ago at the screening, you know, and he knows what he's talking about. He said that James Cameron doesn't owe us anything. And I agree. I wholeheartedly agree. But it's just a shame that James Cameron has spent 20 years working on 3 Avatar films instead of making something else, because he really is one of the greats. But at the same time, I think we play our own part in the success of Avatar. That first film is still the highest grossing picture of all time with $2.9 billion in the bank. The sequel released in 2022, Avatar The Way of Water, despite the fact that you and I hated it and we tried to get people not to go see it, John, it closed its box office run with $2.3 billion in the bank. That's an astonishing figure for any film, but one that was released, you know, just towards the end of the pandemic. That's amazing that people showed up for that, because that all comes from cinema receipts.
When you quote that to me, I'm reminded of Mark Kermode, another great film critic, saying that he was once quoted a YouGov poll, and 97% of the population, when asked which is England's best known film critic or name a film critic, they all said him. And I said, wow. And he said, hang on, 3% of the population said they pay attention to film critics before they go to the cinema. So make of that what you will, but I think it's timely to point that out.
Yeah, it'll be interesting now to see what the Irish box office figures for Avatar Fire and Ash are after this review, but we'll come back to that. But yeah, so it just kind of annoys me that Cameron has done very little else aside from, you know, documentary making. These are the features that he's been working on, that he came away from, you know, the first Avatar and said, I'm just going to focus on gangly blue aliens and their convoluted space cause. And this isn't just something, you know, Cameron decided to come up with in the noughties. You know, he has said before, you know, he tells a famous story of coming out of the first Star Wars film in a, you know, the tail end of the 1970s and thinking to himself, damn it, someone else got there before me, because he had these ideas cooking up in the background. Mm-hmm. But I thought that he would have just got it all out of his system with the first one. He hasn't. So for this film, you really need to have watched the other 6 hours of Avatar Pictures, you know, but I'll recap it very briefly. There's, you know, a man named Jake Sully, who's a former Marine turned Navi prince, who basically flew to the stars, found himself a new alien tribe, a fearless warrior bride, and Zoe Saldana's Neytiri, a whole new planet, a whole new, you know, family, basically. He became an alien. And that was the first film, you know, and you had this case of where his human employers, you know, a human army were so annoyed with him for switching sides. So it was that's where we were getting the whole dances with Smurf sort of, you know, joke that has been used a thousand times before. In the second one, you saw him integrating himself more into this alien society and starting a family with Neytiri. And that second film, you know, it tried to do something new, but it was still bound by the mean old colonel played by, Quaritch played by Stephen Lang. Stephen Lang basically wearing his usual frown. He's the sort of the Darth Vader of the piece. You know, we see him go down in the first film, but no, he's back in the second. We see him go down in the second. He's back in the third. They just can't get rid of him. So in that second film, you had this standoff between the Navi and the humans. And Jake Sully and Neytiri, they lost their son. So this third one picks up a year after that. And you have a case where Neytiri is just inconsolable. But Jake knows that was just a battle. The war still rages on. And it's only a matter of time before the humans come back. What the humans and the good Navi don't expect is for some bad Navi tribes to show up. And that's where you have the so-called Ash people coming in. And these guys are just lunatics. Like, they're just like, they're enemies. Everyone is an enemy to them. So you have this case where maybe Quaritch and Jake Sully are going to have to work together. And you've got a million and one subplots around that. One of which, the only subplot that I found half decent was, you know, the kid Spider, who is the human kid who integrates himself into the Navi without actually turning into a Navi himself. He develops the ability to breathe the air on Pandora. So that kind of spirals into this idea that, you know, he's Quaritch's son, but he's becoming more and more like more and more like Jake Sully. So that sort of like heightens the rivalry between those two men. So I hope you can understand something out of that plot, but that's basically what we're dealing with here.
And okay, so in the last one, what really bugged me more than anything, more than the plot, which was pretty paper thin as well, was how it looked. I just thought it was a screensaver, and the idea that so much money had been spent on this, it was too unreal for me. Is it more of the same in this? I know there's Ash people this time.
There is, yeah. So there's a lot of fire. Every now and then, John, there's a special effect that makes you forget that this thing is essentially a glorified cartoon. And I say that with respect, but let's face it, it really is. There might be something that makes you think, wow, that looks real. You know, there's a splash of water. There's a scene on, you know, where one of the aliens is on a dragon or a Navi dragon, whatever they're called. And you think this genuinely does look real. Most of the time, though, that's like 1 second out of 197 minutes. Most of the time, John, this thing just gave me a headache. And the special effects are supposed to be the defining feature of the Avatar film. You know, there's an awful lot put in. You know, there's an awful lot spoken about the fact that, you know, the cast acted out their roles via performance capture technology. And, you know, good luck to them. That's, you know, fair enough. I think, you know, after this, I'll go away. I think there is a documentary about how these films are made, and I probably have a good time with that. But the finished product, it's ugly. Most of the time, it's just ugly. The 3D overcoat doesn't help. Those annoying 3D glasses are back to, you know, ruin your cinematic experience again.
So you were wearing them while you watched this?
I wore them over glasses, John, which is not ideal. So I had two pairs of glasses on for this. It's not a great look, you know. And when you get up to go to the loo during this thing, because you will have to with a bladder bursting runtime of 3.5 hours, just remember to take off the second pair of glasses. But the other thing that ruins the visual effects for me is the fact that James Cameron has shot this film at a higher frame rate than most, you know, action sci-fi epics. Most films are shot at like 24 frames per second. This is shot at 48 frames per second because James Cameron wanted to sort of make sure that, you know, that he's using so many special effects that he wanted to make sure that the image was crisp and more realistic and to make you feel as though you were fully immersed in that world. Maybe that works momentarily, but what it actually does is it makes you feel as though you're on a walter at an amusement park and you just can't fully focused on it. Everything, it's like someone sat on the fast forward button. You know, the sound is playing at real speed, but the image is going too fast. It's disorientating.
Okay, so listen, 197 minutes. It looks like a screensaver, to put words in your mouth, albeit a very fast one. The plot is pretty paper thin. Where are you going to go stars-wise for Avatar, Fire and Ash?
Yeah, I just thought it was a thunderous bore, John. The plot is paper thin. There's too much going on, but simultaneously not enough going on. You can't really make sense of the performances because they're so buried in that, you know, sci-fi gloop. You know, for James Cameron, a man who gave us some of the best quotes in cinematic history, his dialogue here is so so watery, so unnatural. This thing, like the other films, just has no sort of lasting effect whatsoever. There's no cultural footprint with these films. Without looking it up, you can't remember a single bit of dialogue. You can't remember a character's name. It's, you forget about it while you're watching it. That's how bad it is. So I appreciate all of the effort and all of the money and all of the talent that has gone into these things. And for that, I'll give it 2 stars. But it just, again, it annoys me that Cameron has spent 20 years of an extraordinary career on these utterly forgettable, joyless films.
Yeah, joyless. And it's funny you say that, the cultural imprint. The thing you remember most about it is the jokes about it, which is a damning sign. Okay, so Chris Wasser is giving Avatar Fire... Sorry, I should give it its correct title after we bashed it so much. Avatar Fire and Ash, a joyless 2 stars. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Now, something very different to Avatar is this.
It's a big family, Jane.
My gorgeous daughters.
So lovely they can all be here for you.
I'm here.
I told you never wear yellow because it doesn't suit you.
Oh, no. Now, why don't we have goose for Christmas?
I always like a cheap bird.
Dad, shut up.
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. Mercury is in retrograde, though, you know that.
What do you think they're doing?
Hard to say. I'm not sure about how the girls are doing, June.
I've drawn up a rota. I've made it so you and I don't overlap.
Maybe we should ask Mum what she wants.
Families are hard.
Just please.
That's why I make sure people get good goodbyes.
Yes, that was a clip from Goodbye June, which is now in select cinemas and is landing on Netflix next week on Christmas Eve. It is a Christmas family drama directed in her directorial debut by Kate Winslet from a screenplay written by her son, Joe Anders. It has a large cast, including Toni Collette, Johnny Flynn, Andrea Riseborough, and Winslet herself, playing the children of Helen Mirren, children who don't really get on very well, and they're all in different states of despair, sadness in their lives. Their lives aren't working out maybe the way they thought they would. Kate Winslet's character is quite successful, but she has a pretty contentious relationship with her sister, Andrea Riseborough, who's quite a frazzled person and has problems in her own life. Johnny Flynn's character, the young son, is somewhat disorganized in his life. And then Toni Collette is this kind of live wire who flies in from the west coast of America and is quite flighty generally. And Helen Mirren is the matriarch of this, and it's no spoiler to say she's dying. And we meet her, it's coming up to Christmas, and her plan, I suppose, around her death is to help it focus the children on their relationships and maybe achieve some kind of reconciliation. Timothy Spall plays her husband, who is a kind of classic English husband in this, certainly from a generation ago, who just has his head in the sand about it and doesn't want to face up to the fact that his beloved wife is dying. This is a beautiful film. It's quite sad, but there's a lot of optimism in it as well. I suppose, you know, I've spoken about this before. I don't want to say an anti-Christmas movie, but it's one of those movies that looks at, you know, hard topics around the period of Christmas. It's called Goodbye June. I got to talk to the aforementioned Timothy Spall, the aforementioned Toni Collette, and the aforementioned Andrea Riseborough, people who need no introduction, about the roles in Goodbye June.
Timothy, your character is inarticulate about the grief he's experiencing. that's the way it seems. And he's focusing on other things like football matches and beer. And I was thinking, he seems like a real Irish father. And then I was thinking, well that's just me. He's probably very English and very French and very American. Do you think maybe that that's a very common way a generation might have traditionally dealt with grief?
I think it is up to a point. Yeah, it also depends on what you're like, what your nature is, and how you've cast yourself and how you've been cast by your family. It's very convenient for him to play the character of the buffoon, to play the character of the insouciant and carefree person that's a gagster, an annoyance, an irritant. It's also very conveniently avoidant, so he doesn't have to, you know, face up to or demonstrate what he's feeling. And I think that is a generational to a certain degree, but it's also a smokescreen he throws up to avoid having to do any subtextual exchange or anything. He just wants to get on with it. I mean, there's moments in the movie where you see that he and, June are very much on the same wire. It's just that the kids don't notice it. That is a bond between them. It's just, it is a bloody annoying to them. And really, he doesn't truly connect as far as his son's concerned until he sees him singing a song about how, you know, which is not specific, but it just is a display of absolute grief. I mean, he's grieving, but he's not, it's impossible to display it. You know, it's impossible. They all become, their problems and their character faults are exacerbated by the thing that's going on as well. Being entrapped by the one thing that cannot avoid, the profundity of the death of the centre of the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Tony, I'm wondering, like when the script came to you, you get plenty of scripts, I'm sure. And, you know, the top line is, this is a movie about someone dying. We know that from the get-go. It's also set at Christmas. You know, this is like flying in the face of something like Love Actually or whatever, as good as those movies are. I wonder, did you have any hesitancy about, you know, entering something that's so, on the surface, kind of dark and grim and sad?
I had no hesitation. The script was just so incredible. I mean, you've seen the film and it was glaringly obvious in the writing that there was such compassion and understanding for each of the characters, all the dynamics within this beautifully dysfunctional family. I think Joe's writing and Kate's directing and the incredible cast that was assembled, I had complete confidence that it would be made in the most beautiful way, and we were in unbelievably brilliant hands. But what I didn't know is that everyone was just going to turn out to be a wonderful friend, and that it actually would create an energy of its own, you know, with what everybody brought. And it was a very, very special kind of memorable job, more than a job, a life experience, and one of the best I've ever had.
Wow.
To be a part of it.
Yeah. Andrea, sorry it took me so long to get to you. Your articulate co-stars, though, you can blame them. Your character is...
I take the blame. So are you.
It's a good complaint. Your character, though, is like angry at the start when we meet her, and frazzled. And, you know, like a lot of angry people, there's often a reason for it, and there's a sad reason, and maybe they're hurt or something along that lines. And then, without giving a spoiler, there's a gorgeous scene about an hour into the movie where you talk to Kate, and we have Kate Winslet's character, and we have a completely different understanding of your character. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but for me, that's one of the most important scenes in the movie, or the one that got me, that kind of says, you know what? People we think are angry, there's we need to stand back and ask why they're angry. But you tell me your sense of that scene.
I'm so pleased that you found that scene moving. I think it's a moving scene, really. It sort of reflects the it's so odd as siblings, isn't it, how you can have such a similar experience to one person and have perceived it completely differently, and also taken in all of that experience, and it comes out in a way that seems entirely opposite to another sibling. And that's what's happened with Kate's character and my character. And Julia and Molly have suffered really an estrangement of sorts, which happens so much again with siblings in all sorts of families. And I think more than anything, my character Molly just wants to be recognised and acknowledged, and she wants affirmation from Kate's character, Julia. And so that scene really expresses that. It's frustrating Tim has said it so beautifully many times as we've been talking about the film. It's frustrating to be the way you cast yourself in those roles in a family. You know, it's almost like an archetypal thing that you end up carrying. And then you have to come back to that family and face it again, even though you've perhaps grown or moved on. And June is the one character, the glue that binds, who sort of allows all of those, our characters, to transcend those roles, you know.
I think that scene is particularly powerful because ultimately the film is not about a woman dying. It's about how she helps bring these beautiful people back together. And that scene is really like the gold in the middle of it. It just really expresses the crux of the story.
You know, the recognition of how we carry with us an attitude that, you know, Andrea so beautifully put, that we cast ourselves, we cast each other in these roles. A grievance that
without even knowing it.
Yeah, you don't even know it. Because you're comfortable in it, you know, and you're not. Sometimes the last person you're going to give a break to is the person you love the most because you're familiar with it and you're happy with their familiarity, you know. And sometimes you can be cruel to the people you love because you love them. You know, it's kind of unconditional, even if you're an ass to them.
Yes.
And take something as challenging as confronting as the impending death of the matriarch of the family for other family members to be able to transmute these things they've been carrying through their entire lives.
I think it's...
Stop talking about it.
They can also be really simple reasons. You know, that anger may not come from something very
traumatic
or hugely traumatic. When you care so much about somebody, it can be the smallest of reasons and you can feel let down in perhaps the smallest of ways.
It's inflated because of the love, actually, because of the love action.
Yeah. Love it. Can I finish with you, Tony, and mention another mother? When I've had the opportunity to talk to anyone from Little Miss Sunshine, I always do. When I spoke to Paul Dano, I love that film. And I'm just wondering about that character, because we're talking about families. They're all falling apart in that film. The Proust scholar, the daughter, the grandfather who just wants to eat chicken and talk about Nazi bullets in his backside and all that kind of stuff. And you're holding it all together beautifully. And at times it's like you're not even sure if you're going to, but you do. I wonder, do you have a special place for that particular mother in your acting career? Again, not to put words in your mouth, but I do.
I really do. And funnily enough, it's the 20th anniversary of the premiere of that film. And there's going to be an anniversary screening at Sundance in January. 20 years. But yes, of course, that was an incredible experience. And I mean, not dissimilar to this, actually. I think particularly women, you know, they talk about women multitasking and holding it all together. And that particular character really was. That was a frantic family on the move. And I'm so fond of that experience, all the people involved, and I have such beautiful, dear memories of it. And I don't know whether I'm going to make it to that screening in January, but I hope that I can, just to kind of see everyone again. And John and Val, who directed the movie, and Michael Arndt for that incredible script, and dear Alan Arkin, who's no longer here. It was just a really profound, positive, beautiful one.
It's really nice to
meet you guys.
Lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
Toni Collette there, talking about her time on Little Miss Sunshine, which is now 20 years old. Gosh, that makes me feel old. But her and Andrea Riseborough and Timothy Spall were talking to me ostensibly about Goodbye June, a new Christmas drama, which is on Netflix from next week, the 24th of December. Something very different is the two men who voice Patrick and SpongeBob. They're going to talk to me about the new SpongeBob movie after the break. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. SpongeBob the movie. The SpongeBob movie Search for SquarePants lands in cinemas this weekend from the 19th of December. Desperate to be a big guy, SpongeBob sets out to prove his bravery to Mr. Krabs by following the Flying Dutchman, a mysterious swashbuckling ghost pirate, on a seafaring comedy adventure that takes him to the deepest depths of the deepest sea where no sponge has ever gone before. This is a delightful movie. SpongeBob has been in my life for about 13 years. That's the age of my eldest child. As cartoons go, you know, that you have to watch with your kids,
SpongeBob is right up there. It's so funny. I mean, I don't think you need to me to explain to you what SpongeBob is. It's about a sponge who lives in Bikini Bottom, and he's a delightful character, and he's very sweet, and he's good for kids to watch. So I jumped at a chance to do something about the new SpongeBob movie because I was absolutely delighted to get word that I could talk to Tom Kenny and Bill Fagerback. Who are they? Tom Kenny plays SpongeBob. He voices him and has done for the last 25, 26 years. Bill Fagerback voices Patrick, SpongeBob's best friend. So earlier in the week, from my home studio, why am I telling you I did it from there? Because my kids wanted to come in, but I couldn't let them. As I told Tom and Bill, the two people who voice SpongeBob and Patrick. Hi, guys. Greetings from Dublin, Ireland.
Hi, John Fardy.
Great. Hi, John.
Nice to see you. So listen, guys, I'm sure people say this to you all the time, but well, maybe they don't say this, but I, in this job, have interviewed Julia Roberts, Robert De Niro, George Clooney, and this is not some terrible name drop, but my kids remain wholly unimpressed by all this until today, and I've had to fight to keep them out of the room. So I just want to thank you.
Let them in!
Let them in!
Unbar the door!
That won't be good for anyone.
At least the hounds.
you're like, you don't know my children. They're a nightmare.
They're lovely nightmares. But I want to say thank you.
Because, I've got two of those. So does
yes.
he.
Yes, so I gather. You guys have been with me on this parental journey for the last 13 years. So thank you. Tom, let me ask you this. Is it a strange kind of quirk when you look in your life that you probably... But you can tell me, obviously, but you probably took the gig voicing SpongeBob, you know, oh, I'll do this for 6 months. And now here we are 26 years later. Like, do you look back and go, wow, that's strange what's happened?
Yes. We're always auditioning for things, you know, actor. That's what actors do is audition. And then once in a while you work as an actor. But you're never looking for something to last a quarter century, 25, 26 years.
Unless you're an idiot.
Or the most hopeful person of all time, which you kind of have to be to get into this business, and I'm sure you are too. I had done some stand-up and sketch comedy and some on-camera acting, and I knew that I was handsomer than George Clooney. I know that.
The hair.
I'm better looking than him.
Yeah, the hair. Yeah.
Yet the breaks didn't happen for me. No, I'm kidding. Voiceover is what I always wanted to do. So I auditioned for SpongeBob, met this lovely man, got to know him, I should say, through that. And here we are. But you're not looking for that. It's just kind of, like I said, like just a crazy, like a meteor happening to... a good kind of meteor hitting you.
Yes, right.
A positive meteor.
It was a Steven Hillenburg meteor.
Yeah.
It hit us all. Yeah.
And Bill, in terms of finding Patrick's voice, was it kind of instantaneous when you read the script or you saw the image of him, or did it take a while, or was it a gut punch of I know who this guy is?
It was the audition, actually, because it was a very unconventional audition with Steven Hillenburg, the creator. It wasn't in a studio. It was in a conference room. And here was this little unassuming guy sitting at a meeting table with a tiny black cassette player and a microphone hooked to it. And he said, okay, so you're the best friend of this guy. And he already knew that Tom was going to play at that time Sponge Boy. And he played that. Tom doing the voice, and he said, so you're his friend, so there should be balance, and I felt lucky that was in my wheelhouse, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, you pulled it off. Tom, you know, I often think, especially with guys like you, God, you've been asked these questions a million times, but it's, you know, bear with me. But the woman I had those children with is very interested in education, and I know... You guys have probably heard all the theories. The people who wrote SpongeBob are on LSD. It's a metaphor for communist whatever, blah, blah, blah. But my wife is of the opinion that SpongeBob could be very much seen as an autistic character. He's very factual. He kind of takes everything at its word. He's also incredibly moral, which has a lot of overlap with the neurodiverse way of looking at the world, by all accounts. What do you think of that?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would thank your wife for doing the work that she does. Hats off to her. She also has, obviously, well, the woman that you, is she your wife?
She is, yeah, sorry.
Okay, good. You said the woman I have my kids with. So I didn't want to misname anything. But she also has, she also obviously has great taste in men. So I would say, you know, she's a very smart, perceptive woman. I mean, again, with cartoon characters, it's you can kind of, they're kind of these tabula rosas, these blank slates that you can kind of lay on layers of them. But all those characteristics that your wife noticed, SpongeBob does have. And I do talk to a lot of neurodivergent people and neurodivergent parents of neurodivergent children, and they're very appreciative that they can look at SpongeBob and feel a kinship with the character. So I'm proud of that. I think whatever somebody sees in it is valid.
Yeah, it's I don't believe that, you know, Steven Hillenburg had some master plan of clever under the woven fabric. So I'm going to slide this in there. He just wanted to make a great cartoon that made him happy. And it's interesting what people want to bring to something.
But it's funny. A lot of the characteristics that your significant other noticed can also be applied to many of the other characters, if not most or all of the other characters in the show.
Sure.
Right? Look at Squidward. Look at Mr. Krabs with his money and his counting and you know, Patrick, of course, you know. I think that's a valid interpretation that one can make.
There's a lot of autistic kids that we see if we're out in public that really connect to the cartoon.
And adults, too.
And it's very
empowering. It makes us very proud and happy that they can look at this popular thing, this popular character, and say, hey, I share some traits with this person, you know, this character.
I have to ask, we're out of time, but Kenny, there must be Irish in there, Tom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the first time I went to Ireland, I met three other Tom Kennys within 15 minutes. Like, your name Tom Kenny, so am I. You know, like...
Yes, sorry about that. Listen, thank you. You have done my house some service over the years.
Well,
so it's
lovely
to meet you, Scott. Thanks
for padlocking the door against your progeny.
I better go let them out.
Hey, those kids.
Don't feed them. They'll just get spoiled.
Tom Kenny and Bill Fagerbake, they're talking to me about Unlocking the Children and their voicing Patrick and SpongeBob. All SpongeBob and Patrick's lives, but most notably in the new SpongeBob movie, the SpongeBob movie Search for SquarePants. And you know what? Those guys have been doing this for a long time. Isn't it nice to meet people who are still so enthused by what they do? The SpongeBob movie is great. I took the three kids to it. My youngest one absolutely loved it. And if you're looking for a festive movie for your smaller kids over Christmas, it's dynamite. And my thanks to Tom and Bill there. It was such fun to talk to them. That's it for this week. On Christmas Day, I'm going to be back doing a Christmas time screen time special. Yes, a Christmas screen time special where I'll be playing great Christmas movies and Christmas TV specials and a bit of music from those movies. So it's just something nice and light that it's going out at 11 o'clock on Christmas Day that might suit you as you're cooking breakfast or having your first row or whatever it is you're doing. In the meantime, you can listen back to this or any of the previous screen times by going to the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, you can listen on the radio every Saturday. Just leave you with a little vaguely festive music. This is from The Office, used to brilliant effect in The Office Christmas special. And this is Yazoo with Only You. So I will leave you with this and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend. And I will talk to you Christmas Day, should you feel inclined.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of love. Can you hear me? Yesterday, I'm moving farther away. Won't you near me? All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you.
AI agents are everywhere. automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.